You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
All right, traders, I hope you're ready for this one. We have a really big episode in store. So let's get right into it. My guest this week has been labeled by Forbes as one of the most successful traders of the last 40 years. He was also profiled in Jack Swagger's The New Market Wizards. The man I'm referring to is Blair Hull. Prior to trading, Blair was a serious blackjack player for 5 years during the 70s. From there, he took his winnings to the floor of the Pacific Exchange to trade mispriced options. And shortly after, founded one of the world's premier market-making firms, Hull Trading, in 1985. At its peak, Hull Trading was active on 28 exchanges in 9 countries. Then in 1999, the firm was acquired by Goldman Sachs for $531 million. Today, Blair is the founder of Hull Investments, which is the parent company of an actively managed ETF, Hull Trading Asset Allocation, and proprietary firm Ketchum Trading. Listening to this interview, you're going to hear more about Blair's career and his observations as a trader, why he believes great things happen in teams and having an edge. Because like Blair says, if you're missing an edge, there's no reason to play. So here it is, folks. I'm Aaron Fifield, and here is my interview with a trader who I look up to and greatly respect, Blair Hull. To say before we go any further, it's such a huge honor to have you here on the podcast. So thanks a lot for agreeing to do an interview.
My pleasure.
I'd like to get this underway by asking you about your first trading experience, which started at the blackjack tables. How did you get into blackjack?
Well, my brother-in-law used to go from San Francisco to Tahoe every weekend, or not every weekend, but say every 6 weeks or so, and he'd play blackjack. And he said that he paid for his vacation by going and playing blackjack. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This guy is an accountant. If he were really making money, he wouldn't be playing at the $1 table. He'd be playing at the $5 or the $25 table. And so I didn't really believe him, but I did read the book, Beat the Dealer, and I tried to use it, did it myself to some extent. And I found that there was an edge. You could get an advantage playing blackjack. So for the next 5 years, 1971 to 75, I played 50 days a year in blackjack while I still had a full-time job. But every chance I had, I was in Nevada, either at Reno, Tahoe, or Las Vegas.
Okay, so what was that full-time job that you were holding down at the time?
I was working at Kaiser Cement as a middle manager. I did have an MBA from Santa Clara University and was doing financial analysis for a cement company.
Right, right. Okay. So would you mind telling us a little bit about the strategy that you were playing to win at blackjack? And were you successful with this right away?
Well, this is there's a book called Beat the Dealer by Ed Thorpe that was, it really came out of a academic article. Most things do come out of the academic world that are substantial in 1958. And then it was a hardback in book in 1962 and then a paperback in 1966. And this gave a strategy, and there have been, oh, I'm sure almost 1,000 books written on blackjack since that time that people realized it was a winning game. And of course, with all good things, they do go away. The casinos learned how to counteract the players over a long period of time. It took them until about the year into this century for them to learn to counteract the players to such an extent that it's very difficult to beat the game of blackjack today, but still possible. There are some games that can be beaten.
So when you were playing it, the strategy that you were playing to win at blackjack, was this what you might call a foolproof way of making money? Like, how great was your edge?
Well, nothing's. I wish there were something foolproof, but the best advantage you ever got was 51-49. That means there's a 50. You know, you had a 2% edge. That means for every $100 you bet, you'd win $2. But it takes you a long time to get into the long run. Anytime you'd go up and play for a weekend, you'd play 8 hours a day, two straight days, and you'd still have only a 2 out of 3 chance of being a winner at the end of that weekend. So this was a game of chance. Having the odds in your favor was certainly a game that I learned. I wanted the odds in my favor, not in the game in the odds of somebody else. Now, if I were to play craps or play blackjack or play the slot machines, the odds would be in the casino's favor. And we're going to transition into trading and investing. And William Sharp at Stanford University, a Nobel Prize winner, defined an investment as a sacrifice of current consumption for expected future gain. Well, gambling is just a sacrifice of current consumption for expected future loss. So we want the odds. We want the odds in our favor, but there's still, whether the odds are in your favor or somebody else, there's still a lot of uncertainty.
Okay. And did you ever consider what you were doing as gambling? Like, most people think when they go to the casino, whether they win or lose is pretty much just sheer luck, you know, because they are gambling. Did you ever consider what you were doing as gambling in the traditional sense?
No, I do not consider I consider myself as an investor. I'm not going to play with somebody where the odds are in somebody else's favor. It's just not part of my, anytime I make a wager, whether it's on the golf course or wherever, I must have the edge in my favor.
Absolutely. Okay. So a little bit later on, I know that you became part of a blackjack team. I know this was a strategic move on your part. What were the advantages you saw from joining a team and playing blackjack?
Well, I have a philosophy that all great things that happen in our world happen with teams, not with individuals. And I learned that at an early age with the blackjack team. The first thing that I did when I learned about the blackjack team is I met the founder, and then I had to go take some tests, some exams. One of the exams was you took a 52-card deck and you took 2 cards out, and then he put a stopwatch and he said, ready, go. He wanted you to count the cards and to tell you what the last 2 cards were and be correct all the time. And so I had to be relatively fast. So I learned how to develop a skill of being faster counting the cards. The second thing I had to do is I had to take a basic strategy test, and that is what do you do when you know what the dealer has and you know what's your cards? And it's usually a multiple choice question, hit, stand, split, or double. And so I took that test, and I got 94 out of 100 right. Well, blackjack really requires that you get all the answers right. You're going to give something back to the, you're going to give them an edge back to the casino. So the fact that we took exams, and there were 10 different time tests in order to qualify for the exam, led me to be a much better blackjack player than I was originally.
Okay. And did the one of the motives for joining a team was that you were able to get more bets on, you were able to play more hands and that sort of thing. Was that one of the reasons for joining the team as well?
Well, certainly it did help to get more money into action. More individual bets allowed you to get into the long run sooner. So that was an advantage. That was part of it.
Okay, excellent. So what was it that motivated you to up and leave the blackjack tables for the floor of the CBOE?
Well, actually, the team got barred. We all got barred in 1970, I guess it was early 76. And so it was hard to get a game. And so, but at the same time, I had been working on developing a model that would calculate the expected value of an option. And I associated a probability distribution with the stock outcome. And then I calculated the net present value of the expectation. And that model actually converges to another model that was developed a year earlier called the Black-Scholes model. So I had developed something very similar that very close to the Black-Scholes model at the same time it was developed. So I had a value for the option, and then I tried to buy under cheap options and I tried to sell expensive options. That was the strategy.
Okay, and if you had to summarize it for us, what ways did blackjack help you to prepare for trading? And why were you, actually you kind of answered that, I was going to ask you, why were you attracted to options markets over other types of markets?
Well, the blackjack, in any kind of a game, whether it's gambling or investing or whatever you call it, there are two things you need. You need an advantage, and then you need to stay in the game. And what blackjack taught me is that I had to bet in proportion to my bankroll. I had to bet in proportion to my advantage. If I had a big advantage, I could bet more money, but never more than 1/50th of my bankroll. So if I had $100, I could never bet more than $2. So that's a pretty good rule. You think about it, you're going to go to the casino and you have $10,000. The most you can bet is $200. Or you will risk ruin. You'll risk losing all your money. So when you're playing a game, whether it be trading or blackjack, and you lose half your money, you have to cut your bets in half. And most people would try to get even. But you have to do the opposite. So I'd say staying in the game was the most important thing that I learned. In fact, you mentioned CBOE. I actually started on the Pacific Stock Exchange, where I leased a seat for $500 a month. But I would go around and there would be an option that would be, all the public were going after this option. It was, I had it worth, according to my model, of say 25 cents, and it was selling for a dollar. And so I had sold maybe 200 of these options, and I'd run around and I'd say, oh, that's such a juicy bet. And then I'd say, I'd look at the price again. Oh, I got to sell some more of those. And then I'd say, I've already have that bet on the table. I envisioned a stack of chips. And so I wouldn't overbet. And so overbetting is the thing that kills you in any kind of game. You can have a winning strategy, but because of the way in which you wager, you can almost be guaranteed to go broke. So it's important as to whether you have an advantage. How much you bet is as important as getting an advantage.
The models that you created, that you had calculated, did these set you up to be a profitable trader pretty much straight out of the gate?
Well, I don't know if it's straight out of the gate. I think I remember I was down $1,000. I took $25,000 that I had won on the blackjack tables. This is in 1974 dollars, so you'd probably put about almost a 10 on that, I guess. But 10 multiple on it in today's dollars. I was pretty successful, fairly successful the first year, fairly successful. Yes, there were, at those days, options were mispriced, and it was much easier to to beat that game much easier than it is today.
Yeah. Can you just give us a bit of an example and kind of explain the idea about options being mispriced? Do you have like some sort of a basic example to help us understand what you mean by mispriced?
Well, one thing about options is that they do tend to be overpriced. If there were a tendency for options at all to be priced, they tend to be overpriced because there are fewer people that can sell options. Everybody can buy an option because the clearing firm or the brokerage firm, Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley, you put a certain amount of money. Let's say you put $10,000 into account. If you pay for an option, you pay for it out of your account and you own it and you get the payoff after. If you sell an option, you need a certain amount of collateral, but they have to keep track of the collateral and they won't let people sell options unless they have a fair amount of money in their account and they know what they're doing. So although it's a risky endeavor, selling options is definitely preferable to buying options as a general rule. So that would be one way of a mispricing of an option. Now, not all options are mispriced, but if they're mispriced, they tend to be overpriced rather than underpriced.
Right. So can you tell us a little bit about how you traded the 87 crash? I know this was a very big day for you, where you made a significant amount of money, as most people were losing a significant amount of money. Can you just tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, the 87 crash, we had options on in all kinds of places. By 1987, and I went down to the floor in 1977, we had built an organization and had about 19 people working together. Now, I realize that I am a believer in teams, but I did start as an individual and then hired somebody, and then we made a partnership, and so there was a team of us, 19 people in various positions. It was interesting that the Federal Reserve and the banks tightened credit at the worst time. They suddenly told everybody that they had to reduce their positions. So that put me in a position that we actually happened to be short the major market index, which was a mirror of the Dow on that day, on Tuesday when the market reached a low. And I had to go over to the Chicago Board of Trade because I was the only person that could actually trade on that seat. We least owned and leased seats on the major exchanges. And so I was actually in that pit at that time. And it was interesting that the New York Stock Exchange, with everybody had panicked. They didn't know what to do. And the Chicago Mercantile was going to halt trading. And I said, I was trying to figure out what happens on trading halts. And I finally told everybody that that's the culmination of panic after when they've halted. So we want to be long on the halt. And then I was in the right place at the right time when a firm that used to exist, Drexel Burnham, and they went out of business not too long afterwards, came to the floor, and the Chicago Mercantile had shut down. So the only place they were trading equities was the Chicago Board of Trade in this major market index. And they asked me where would I buy 100. They knew that I was a guy that was on both sides of the market, and I said, gave them a ridiculously low price, and they said sold. He later sold me another 50, and there was the only 150 contracts that traded at that price. So I was in the right place at the right time.
So you bought those, I believe it was around about like 2 ticks off the lowest price. Was that right?
I think that is right. There was another trade. There was another small trade. There were 150 lots at 285. There was a 2-lot that traded at 287, and then there was some traded 290, but that's sort of interesting. 2 ticks. Well, that was the low price. The price that I brought them with a low price, and there were no other trades at that price. But I'm sure you're curious, how did you get that information? With 2 ticks off the low. You said 2 ticks. No, it actually was the low. My contract was, you said 2 ticks off the low. Where did you get that?
Oh, okay. Oh, I must have misheard it or misread it somewhere.
Yeah. So it actually was the low price, 150 contracts. was at Low Tech.
So that was 87. In 85, you started Hull Trading, which I'm really keen to ask you more about. So how did Hull Trading come to be, and what were your objectives for starting this firm?
Well, it was an extenuation of my own trading. Normally on the floor of exchange, a trader would have clerks. And I actually had, I had tried to build a computer system. I knew that things ought to be automated. And when I saw the exchanges and the first time I walked down, having been a computer programmer before, having some programming experience, I should say, I knew that when I saw the floor of the exchange in 1976, I said, this place, my God, if I come down here, I better make a lot of money very quick because it's all going to be automated. Now, the direction of technology, I knew the direction of technology, but my timing was off by about 30 years. It took us until about the year 2000 to actually get automated options exchanges.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about what were some of the things that you were doing at Hull Trading, which were very unique and innovative for that point in time?
Well, when we had a decision to make, we usually wrote an algorithm and created a system that would execute that trade. We did believe that everything that we were doing by hand could be done by a machine. And so we were, when exchanges, you know, we have the status quo at a lot of things, and it's hard to break the status quo when it was finally broken in about 1990 in Germany. Germany actually had the first automated options exchange out of the Deutsche Thermosbüro, which became Eurex. They were the first ones to do it, and we were over there in Europe providing liquidity on those exchanges, so we learned in Europe.
Okay. Now, one of the things which I find quite interesting about Hull Trading, and I'm hoping you can share a little bit about this, is the type of people that you were hiring there. I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you were sort of one of the first to employ, you know, your PhDs and mathematicians and those sorts of people over the traditional trader types. What was your reasoning for this?
Well, I had had a job in corporate America, so I looked at things as in from an organizational standpoint. And we did believe that one needed an objective way of buying and selling things. You couldn't, especially in the options market where everything was related. And so we had quantitative models that would tell us how to price the SPX options versus the NASDAQ options, say. And so we needed mathematicians and computer scientists to not only come up with the algorithms that would give us fair values, to risk adjust those fair values and then automate that process to get those prices to the traders. And that took a lot of higher mathematics and computer skills to do that.
Okay. Could you give us a little bit of insight to how you would describe some of the strategies that you were running there at Hull Trading? Like maybe sort of the frequency, what sort of markets you were involved in, obviously options markets, but I think you were in about 9 different countries at the peak. Just tell us a little bit about the type of strategies that you were running.
Well, most of them were, we were trying to buy undervalued securities and sell overvalued securities and stay as neutral as possible. Nobody liked risk, but our capital would swing significant amounts on any one day just because things became more mispriced or less mispriced. So the strategies, although we did do a lot of option strategies, and of course we hedged with the underlying instrument. If we'd sell calls on IBM, chances are we were a buyer of the stock, or we were doing some other option to offset that transaction so that we would be relatively neutral IBM. But another strategy that we employed about 1995 actually, was we bought and sold securities in a separate portfolio. So we were operating on, I think it was called the DOT system then, and so we automated a process. And we would do things like, you might think of it as pairs trading, where you would buy one stock Pepsi and sell Coke, or used to be General Motors and Ford, or it might be Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, where we would. But what we did is we really took a security and we took the five most correlated securities and we built a basket. And then we'd say that this stock is going to follow that basket. So if that industry tended to go higher, we would tend to be a buyer of that stock, et cetera. So we try to fairly price securities, and then we would make a market around our fair value. Everything we did was to come up with a fair value and then put a bid and an offer around that fair value, never thinking that we were going one direction, but always being willing to go both directions.
Okay. So Hull grew at an incredibly fast pace. At your peak, how much volume did you account for in the various options markets that you traded?
Oh, that's hard to tell. I do think, we were certainly large in Chicago. We were in Frankfurt, London, Paris. And we were in Tokyo. We had a joint venture with Daiwa Securities, which was certainly interesting. So it's hard to say. We were doing over 1% of the New York Stock Exchange stock buying, equity buying, though, at that time. Actually, one of the firms we did trade with a lot was Madoff, and this is with a legitimate portion of their operation. But Peter Madoff and I were both served on the Cincinnati Stock Exchange board. And we found that Peter and I didn't see the world in the same way. He had a firm that executed order flow for other people at various prices. And so sometimes he liked to trade them above the market or below the market. And we had an automated system that was would provide bids and offers around what we considered a fair value. We didn't really care who we traded with. Well, Peter Madoff had this idea that he thought we shouldn't be in there providing this liquidity, and we shouldn't be getting in the front of his trades. And I think I get one of my greatest compliments was that Peter Madoff said, "That goddamn guy Hull, he's costing me $250,000 a month. Got to get rid of him." So it's my greatest compliment.
I like that. That's funny as. In 1999, you were acquired by Goldman Sachs. What was Goldman's motive for acquiring Hull Trading?
They saw the way the world was going. They couldn't compete without an automated electronic market maker that could analyze data and come up with fair values for securities so that they could trade them. They could provide good liquidity for their customers and for others. They saw that they could build what we had. Probably going to take them about 2 years to get where we were, but by that time we'd be 18 months ahead of them. So they just wanted to shortcut the process.
Okay. And what did they do with the firm following the acquisition?
Well, the first thing they did, which was really quite bright, they went on a hiring spree. There were 250 people in the firm when when we sold. Within a year, they had 450 people. So what they did is they actually Henry Paulson said this. He said, "I look at this as a DNA transfer. And what we're going to do is we're going to take your methodology and the way you look at problems and markets, and we're going to take that throughout our firm." And so I thought that they were very effective in the way in which they hired and trained people.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then They made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Moving into current times, can you describe to us what is Hull Tactical Funds? Like, give us the rundown on what you're doing today.
Well, one of the things, I talked about blackjack and I talked about option strategies. I actually have been intrigued with the direction of the general market. And I have felt that there's got to be some edge in whether the Dow Jones and the S&P 500 are going up or down on any one day. And not necessarily one day, but over a longer period of time and over multiple horizons. And I actually presented a paper in 1981 where I was on a panel actually with Ed Thorpe, who presented another paper. But what my paper did, it talked about gambling and timing the market. And what I concluded was that gambling was gave me a better return on my investment. Blackjack gave me a better return on my investment relative to risk, and options did the same thing. So for the next 18 years, I sort of said, hey, timing the market isn't for me. But I returned to that strategy in about 2006 and was working on a very short-term strategy. Then in 2008, when the market collapsed, I said, I've got to have a systematic and disciplined way to deal with this. And that's when I started to really work to develop a strategy for really timing the market. So it's pure market timing. Can you be on the right side of the S&P 500? And that's what the Hull Tactical Funds is about, and the ETF, which is HTUS, is the symbol, and it's been operating for about a year.
Okay, and that paper you referred to, I believe that's available online for everyone to see, isn't it?
Oh, yes. We have a paper that is very transparent about our strategy, and it's on a website called hullinvest.com, or you can get it through the Social Science Research Network, SSRN, and just Google Blair Hull. It's called a Practitioner's Defense of Return Predictability.
Okay. Well, I'll link to that in the show notes as well. So you'll also be able to find a link to it there.
The basic idea here is that there's this stigma against market timing, whether it's the Nobel Prize winners, everybody says Vanguard funds have been, they are created by the idea that you can't time the market and that timing the market is dangerous. Well, that may have been true up to about year 2000, but with this explosion of data that we've had with new government data, the internet, even Twitter and social media, we now have a situation where with new predictive analytics that it is now possible to time the market. Just as we have cars being driven by machine learning techniques, it's now that your portfolio should be driven by predictive analytics.
So I just want to be very clear here. When you're talking about market timing, what does that actually refer to? You're talking about like buying the very bottom, selling the top, like could you just elaborate on what you mean by market timing, please?
What we believe is we believe that there is some optimal position of equities and cash that you should have every single day. And that comes out of a variety of information. So what we do is we actually publish this an hour later. And one of the ways, if you look at hullinvest.com, you don't have to buy the ETF, or all you have to do is copy our strategy, because we give you what our optimal position. We have a short-term model, and we have multiple long. We have a long-term model and multiple short-term models, and we have a short-term adjustment to our long-term, and we have a position every day. So you could just copy our strategy. That would be one easy way to do it.
Okay, so this might be a bit of a newbie question, but what's the benefit of creating your own ETF? Like, how do you make money from that? Like, how does that work?
Well, there's a fee that goes along with every ETF that you buy, even if it's the S&P 500. Like the spiders have a 9 basis point fee associated with it. So you're going to pay for every $100 you have invested, you're going to pay 9 cents a year on that. And most fees could go up to, they could be up to 1.5 or 2%. The fee for this fund is 1%, and that's 93 basis points go to the people who put the fund up, put the ETF, and have the strategy, of which we get about 2/3 of that, because there's a variety of things that you have to pay for. So it basically, any ETF that you buy, you're paying there's an expense ratio associated with every ETF.
Okay. That makes sense. That's something I was completely unaware of. So what are the securities that make up your ETF? Are they, I mean, really just cash and what is it? The S&P futures?
It's cash and either the S&P futures or spiders, the ETF. Either those, one or those two, and we may be long or short. The fund can go 200% long, or it can go it can be as little as one. It can be 100% short.
Got it. Okay. Well, Blair, just for the later part of this of our discussion here, I'd like to get some guidance from you for upcoming traders. Now, one of the things you've kind of really, it's kind of been the underlying theme for our conversation so far, which I've noticed, and you've obviously talked about it and talks you've given in the past, is the necessity of having an edge and having an advantage whenever you come to, you know, a game such as trading. What is your definition of a trading edge?
My definition of a trading edge is that if you do this trade multiple times, you will come out on top. You end up making money. That's the definition. If you did this same kind of trade, whether it was with this chart pattern or with this relationship of these things, and you did it hundreds of times, in the long run, you would have more money than you started with. That's my definition of an edge.
So if a trader feels as though they do not have an edge, right, and that's a problem that, and it's a reality for a lot of traders coming into this business, is that they do not have an edge. What should they do in an attempt to try and get one? Like, where's maybe the, I don't know, where should they even start? Like, do you have any advice? I know it's a bit of a difficult question, but do you have any advice that might point them in the right direction for where to look for an edge?
You're probably not going to like this answer, but if you were to go to a casino, let's talk about going to a casino, and you didn't count the cards, so you're not going to play blackjack, but you can play roulette, you can play craps, you can play, baccarat, poker, but you didn't have an edge. So that means that every hundred, all you got to figure out is that for every $100 I bet, how much am I going to lose? Am I going to come out? Because you're going to, and that's your disadvantage. So if you have a disadvantage of all the games you're going to play, my recommendation is that if you're an investor, and that's what I am, I would not play. I'm not going to play. If I'm missing an edge, there's no reason to play. There's no reason to play. There's a reason to give other people money. I mean, if you get some joy out of, and that's where gambling comes in. There's some joy. People enjoy the fluctuation. It's a fun game.
It's a fun game to do it, but not for you. Don't do it for financial reasons. It's only going to hurt you financially if you don't have an advantage. We're doing that. We have a proprietary, I have a proprietary trading. We have the ETF, which we hope has an advantage, and we trade. We have a proprietary trading system that has servers. We do things with computers. We have computers that trade. We don't have people that trade. And these, we have 25 different servers at Aurora at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Well, each of those, and we're trying to figure out, did this server and this strategy lose its edge? Because we have our capital fluctuations go up and down. We probably do any on each one of these servers, we do anywhere from 100 trades to 2,000 trades. I would think on these each of these servers, well, maybe could be up to we could do 4,000 trades in one server, sure, easily. We're evaluating those trades. We look at the trade from the time when we transact it, and we look at the P&L 1 minute later, 5 minutes later, and an hour later. And then, of course, we look at it at the end of the day. So each of those trades are sort of marked out in the future. So and then we go back and do a postmortem to say which trades were effective and which weren't. So we're always worried that our strategies are losing an advantage. In fact, you should assume that whatever trading system you have, the profitability is going to go down because somebody's going to discover that, and they're going to take part of the action.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this is something I want to ask you about is, you can almost be quoted as saying you need to be systematic. It may seem obvious to you why there's a need to be systematic, but would you mind explaining for anyone listening to this podcast why you believe there's a need to be systematic in your trading approach?
Let's see. I keep going back to the game of blackjack because you count the cards and if you have a positive count, that means the odds are in your favor. So you'll bet some money during that time. If it's a negative count, you bet as little as you can. So we just read, we try to determine what our advantage is, and we bet in proportion to that advantage in a systematic way, in a disciplined, systematic way. There's so much randomness that occurs in the marketplace. You got to reduce the randomness to any extent you can, and doing it in a systematic way is the only way that I know about of getting more consistency. We want consistent profits, and those are hard to obtain. So we want to remove as much randomness as we can, and by being systematic, that's
a really great answer, Blair. I like how you described that as removing randomness from markets, from your trading as much as possible. When you're evaluating a strategy, what are the most important performance metrics which you give the highest value to?
Well, there are all kinds of things. There's the return per trade and the return on capital and the hit rate. What percentage of the time are you correct? There's down, how much time underwater. I love that one. That's time underwater. There's maximum drawdown. I mean, there. You could go on and on. You get these reports of this strategy from a money manager. He's got 26 different measures, and so the one, and some people say, there's the Sharpe ratio, which is the return divided by the standard deviation of return, and there's the Sortino ratio, which says it's the return, but it only takes the standard deviation of the downside of when you lose money. I'm real simple. I just take the return divided by the standard deviation of the returns and annualizing that number, the Sharpe ratio. And Sharpe ratios over 2 I like, and Sharpe ratios under 2, I will take Sharpe ratios up above 1. I'll take Sharpe ratios above 1. I don't like Sharpe ratios below 1.
Okay, so a Sharpe ratio less than 1, if anyone is trading a strategy with a Sharpe ratio less than 1, you would sort of discourage that?
I'm not very excited about those.
Okay.
Of course, if you combine a lot of Sharpe ratios of 1, you can get Sharpe ratios of 2 or 3. And we have a trading firm that, of course, it's got lots of servers and all kinds of overhead. But there are many traders that have always, their entire life, they've traded with Sharpe ratios over 10.
Over 10?
Over 10, yes.
That's huge.
Now, the problem is they have all kinds of costs associated with that. And a lot of this requires those servers at the Chicago Mercantile I was talking about. Those are pretty expensive. You know, it's costing us, I'm sure, I don't even know what our bill is over there, but I'm sure it's $50,000 to $100,000
a month. Wow, okay. So in your personal opinion, young traders coming into this business today, where do you believe they should be focusing their efforts?
Well, I think I'm assuming that they have a good education. I'm assuming they have at least an undergraduate degree and that they've taken some quantitative courses in their math, and they've at least gone through calculus in there. So I would say they'd concentrate their efforts in making sure they're up to date on new techniques. I did go to graduate business school, but there are now quantitative finance programs all over the country. There must be 30 of them, which are master's degrees in financial engineering. I'd make sure that they, at the earliest possible age, that they pick up a computer language, and Python or R would be the languages I would recommend that they code in. If you don't code in a language, you don't get an RDoR. There's no question about it. You don't even apply for a trading job unless you can program and well in one of those two languages.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point you make there, Blair. So if someone is very efficient in one of those languages you mentioned, I believe it Ketchum Trading R is the language that you focus on there. If someone is very efficient in R, let's say, but has no trading experience, are they someone who you still may consider for a position with you?
We might do that. They would be up against some other top competition with somebody that probably without a master's degree in finance or some experience if they were just an R programmer or Python. Now, we might take a C++ developer who didn't have we might do that, but certainly the financial engineers would have to have some either education or experience in the financial markets.
Okay, sure. Very good. So just one last question before we close this out. Do you believe it's become harder for traders to make money in the past 10 years or so? And if that's the case, do you think it's going to continue to get harder for traders to make money in these markets?
Well, I have this idea that markets do, it's just water seeks its own level, and markets are meant to be more efficient every day. And so that means that no matter what you do, your edge is going away a little bit each day. And that it really takes, but there are tremendous opportunities and quantum breakthroughs in doing things that people have not thought about before. So I do think there are tremendous opportunities. At the same time, whatever strategy you have today is going to be less profitable tomorrow.
Okay. Well, Blair, it's been incredible having you on the podcast. Once again, thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me and share a lot of your insight with everyone who's listening to this podcast right now. So where can listeners go to find out more about you?
Well, hullinvest.com is the website that we have where there's more information on the ETF, the exchange traded fund, HTUS. And there's also the read the paper. It would be interesting for you to read the paper, Practitioner's Defense of Return Predictability, and then take the quiz that is on the website. There's a quiz that will test your knowledge of predicting the market. It's all about education.
And that quiz is on the Hull Invest website?
Hullinvest.com, yes.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It's been a huge honor. Let's speak soon.
Very good.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.